This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson. We'll be talking today about international diplomacy in the context of the war in Gaza and the risks of a wider Mideast war. But first, news. An Israeli strike in southern Lebanon January 8th killed a top Hezbollah commander, Wissam Tawil, raising tensions between Israel and Hezbollah already high after an Israeli assassination of a Hamas leader in Beirut the week before. The Washington Post reported U.S. officials are concerned that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu may initiate a full-scale war with Hezbollah in order to save his political career. The liberal Zionist group Americans for Peace Now has issued a statement calling for an end to the Israel-Hamas war, the first U.S. Zionist organization to do so. The January 8th statement said, "Continuing this devastating war poses unacceptable risks for Israel, Gazan civilians, and the entire region." The Israeli Supreme Court has denied a petition by foreign journalists seeking permission to report from Gaza. Currently, foreign journalists are not allowed entry into Gaza unless they accompany Israeli soldiers and submit their articles to Israeli censors. The High Court ruled January 8th that allowing journalists independent access to Gaza could jeopardize the security of Israeli soldiers. In Gaza, Palestinian journalists continue to die at a rate many times higher than the general population, with two more journalists killed January 7th and a third injured. Reporters Without Borders stated it appeared a single rocket had hit the car the journalists were traveling in, indicating a targeted strike. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate charges that of the 109 journalists who have been killed since the war in Gaza began, at least 96 of them were deliberately and specifically targeted by Israel. My guest today is Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., where she directs the New Internationalism Project focused on U.S. militarism, the Middle East, and the United Nations. She's the author and editor of 11 books on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, including Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates the United Nations. Her book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, was recently updated and is now in its 7th edition. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Good to be with you.
I want to ask you about a spate of recent events that are raising tensions in the Middle East. One is Israel's assassination of a senior Hamas leader in Beirut on January 2nd, Saleh al-Arouri. He was the deputy chief of Hamas's political bureau. There's been low-intensity fighting along the Israeli-Lebanese border since October 7th between Israel and Hezbollah. The strike that killed al-Arouri and six other Hamas members was a provocative act violating Lebanese sovereignty and something of a gauntlet thrown at the feet of Hezbollah. Why do you think the Israeli government chose to take this action? What do you think the effect is likely to be?
This is not new for Israel. They have been carrying out policies of assassinations around the world for many years. And in the context of this phase of the war, this war did not begin on October 7th, but a particular phase of it did. In that context, Israel announced quite publicly that they intended to hunt down anyone who they claim was involved with the attacks of October 7th, that they will be hunted down wherever they are, knowing that Hezbollah has said publicly that the assassination of any person by Israel on Lebanese territory would be a red line for which there would be a retaliation. And Hezbollah has just announced in the last 2 days that there will be retaliation against Israel. But this is the Israeli policy. They have relied for decades on U.S. guarantees of protection, so they will never be held accountable for these kinds of illegal and provocative actions, these assassinations around the world. Saleh al-Arouri was a very important leader of Hamas. It was clearly going to be a major provocation. That is not of concern of the Israelis, since their position has always been to rely on the U.S. guarantees that they will not be held accountable, and that seems to be holding so far.
Since the latter part of December, Houthi militants in Yemen have launched at least 23 attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea, which they claimed were helping Israel's war effort in some way. The United States and 12 allies warned the Houthis to stop, but Wednesday, January 4th, just hours after the warning, a sea drone was launched from Yemen. An emergency session of the U.S. Security Council was held Wednesday, where the U.S. called for urgent U.N. action and blamed Iran for supplying the Houthis with money and weapons. What was or is U.S. seeking from the Security Council and isn't likely to get it. Given that the Houthis don't seem intimidated, are we going to see more lethal confrontations in the Red Sea? There's already been one with Houthi sailors killed.
There's a very significant danger right now of the fighting in Gaza expanding to a wider regional war. Much of the mainstream media in the U.S. is framing this as a situation in which the United States is somehow being reluctantly dragged in to other people's wars, essentially. The reality is that while the genocide is continuing in Gaza, throughout the region, U.S. actions and some Israeli actions too, but particularly as U.S. actions on the regional level, are helping to escalate that threat of a wider war. The claim the U.S. is making is that it's escalating its own military presence to supposedly deter Iranian or Hezbollah action. In fact, it's having exactly the opposite impact. It's having the impact of significant escalation. As you mentioned, the Houthis had attacked some ships in the Red Sea only after the U.S. had deployed two giant aircraft carrier groups with all of their warplanes, all of their warships that accompany the carriers themselves, in a major escalation by itself. The Houthis then attacked some ships, and the U.S. response was to gather an essentially a wartime armada involving the navies of 10 different countries and attack the Houthi ships directly, killed several of the Houthis. At the same time, the U.S. escalated its bombing in Iraq on January 4th, killed two members of one of the militias that have historically been allied with Iran, and injured many more in a situation which at least one member of the Iraqi parliament said was a clear violation of Iraq's sovereignty. Iraq is supposedly an ally of the United States after the war and occupation, but there are still, of course, more than 2,500 U.S. troops deployed in Iraq. Hundreds more in Syria. The U.S. is now sending 900 more troops to the region. So there's a major escalation underway by the U.S., all in the name of supposedly deterring Iran, when in fact, of course, it's having exactly the opposite impact. So far, Iran has made very clear it has no desire to get into a direct war with either the United States or Israel. But the U.S. is continuing this very provocative set of activities, as is Israel. That really needs to stop. And that's something that we in the United States need to take a great deal of responsibility for. The U.S. has already been vetoing efforts in the United Nations to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. The administration in Washington has now sent over $100 million worth of more weapons to Israel without congressional approval, because it knew it was not going to get it quickly, and is trying to negotiate with Congress for $14 billion more in military aid to Israel. So all of this is very, very dangerous, very provocative, and we need to launch campaigns here to get the U.S. to pull back, to stop these attacks, to prevent Israel from using U.S.-provided arms, to stop transferring weapons to Israel in violation, ironically, of Biden's own conventional arms transfer policy, something that he put forward on the first day of his administration. All of this happens in the context of the need for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, the immediate access to unfettered amounts of humanitarian aid, an end to further displacement of Palestinians. This is a very dangerous moment.
As you've mentioned, the United States has vetoed two UN Security Council resolutions in favor of a ceasefire. One of your areas of expertise is United Nations. Is there anything the United Nations could be doing that it is not already doing to arrive at a ceasefire?
Oh, there's a lot they could do. They could, for example, when the last Security Council resolution was being negotiated, the Council spent 4 days negotiating with the U.S. The U.S. had said, we're going to veto this. And the Council said, no, don't veto. We'll change it. What do you need to change? What would get you on board? And they proceeded to weaken the resolution and weaken it and weaken it. And at the end of the day, what a surprise, the U.S. still didn't vote for it, although it did abstain, allowing one aspect of it to pass, but without any teeth. It would have been better if the Security Council had stood their ground on what was actually required. The United Nations Charter begins with the goal of ending the scourge of war. That largely rests with the Security Council. What they needed to do at that moment was to stand their ground and say, we are going to require a ceasefire. And if the U.S. vetoes, so be it. Because then it goes automatically, the same resolution, to the General Assembly, which can and did, in fact, take up the call and voted overwhelmingly for a ceasefire. In that situation, while Security Council resolutions are acknowledged to be part of international law, they are enforceable, although they rarely are enforced, and General Assembly resolutions officially are considered advisory and not enforceable, that situation is actually rather fluid. And under certain circumstances, General Assembly resolutions can be considered enforceable. They could have moved under those conditions to pass another General Assembly resolution for a ceasefire under these particular terms that would have made it at least arguably enforceable. The other thing that's important to recognize is that it's not only about what the resolutions say the UN itself should do. It's also about what UN resolutions say individual countries should do. So if we look back, for example, in the late 1970s and throughout the 1980s, in the era of the global mobilization against apartheid in South Africa, one of the things that we saw was that the United Nations was rarely able to pass anti-apartheid resolutions in the Security Council because, like now with Israel, the US would use its veto to protect apartheid South Africa. Most of those resolutions were passed in the General Assembly. And while they were not enforceable, they became a tool for activists in all these countries around the world to use to persuade their own governments to begin to carry out those recommendations. So things like arms embargoes. The arms embargo was passed very early by the General Assembly. It didn't become part of international law the way a Security Council resolution would have, but it became the model for countries all around the world to stop selling or buying arms to or from apartheid South Africa. That expanded to a broader boycott. It expanded to the banking restrictions and the corporate withdrawals. All of that led to enough pressure that eventually, with amazing work from the Congressional Black Caucus and Black churches around this country, the United States ultimately was forced by global pressure to join in boycotting and sanctioning apartheid South Africa. Exactly that same thing could happen right now at the UN.
If the UN General Assembly does pass something and it has special weight, how can it be implemented?
The United Nations as a whole is sort of like that old saying about the Pope. How many armies does he have? The United Nations does not have an army or even an international police force to enforce its demands militarily, but it holds enormous political and diplomatic power. When a resolution is passed by the Security Council, or in the case of the Uniting for Peace precedent from 1951, it takes a lot of chutzpah, we might say, for a country to simply ignore it. It happens. And Israel, as we know, is a country of great chutzpah, meaning that it is willing to act out in those ways. But it provides important political and diplomatic cover for every government that wants to do the right thing. In the current motion, we're seeing this extraordinary move by South Africa to bring Israel to trial in the International Court of Justice for violation of the conditions of the International Convention for the Prevention of the Crime of Genocide. Any country that wants to support that, or before South Africa took that very brave decision to take such an initiative, would face enormous pressure from the United States. And most countries are simply not willing to do that, particularly when it's not about their own interests, when it's about international morality, we might say, to prevent the slaughter that is now underway in Gaza. But when there is a resolution of the General Assembly or of the Security Council calling for all countries to stop transferring weapons to Israel, for instance, to withdraw their diplomats from Israel, those kinds of actions. When they do that and United States diplomats come to call and say, what do you think you're doing? We're going to punish you in some way. We're going to take action against you. What they have to fight back is to hold up this resolution and say, we are abiding by a UN resolution. We had no choice here. We believe in international law. And when the United Nations says something, that's what we do. We're sorry you don't agree with us, but that's why we're doing it. It gives them a basis for fighting back. That's why it's important.
If you're just tuning in, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies about how international law and conventions apply to the war in Gaza. What could be the upshot of this case that South Africa has brought to the International Court of Justice? What is the ICJ being asked to adjudicate, and what happens if the case is successful?
It's an extraordinary case. The South Africans have filed an 85-page document that is one of the most comprehensive examinations of Israeli violations of the Genocide Convention that we've seen so far. It documents the two parts of the crime of genocide. Genocide is a very specific kind of crime, and it requires two different things. First, it requires that there be evidence of specific intent, that you have to carry out certain illegal acts for a specific goal. And the goal has to be the goal of destroying in whole or in part a specific group. A group can be defined by race, religion, ethnic background, place of residence, all different categories. So the Palestinians of Gaza are such a group. Israeli officials, and this is all documented in the South African application, Israeli officials from the president, the prime minister, members of the Knesset, high-ranking military officials have all used extraordinary language that indicates their intentions. They've used language like, we should use nuclear weapons against everyone in Gaza. There are no civilians in Gaza. These are human animals. The prime minister, Netanyahu, used a biblical reference of the story of Amalek, where God calls on the Israelites to annihilate the entire community of their enemies and says explicitly, kill them all for your revenge. Kill them all, including women, children, and sucking babies. Kill the animals they rely on. Kill them all. It's language reminiscent of the genocidal language of the Indian wars in this country, when famous generals leading U.S. troops in the Indian wars of the mid-1800s use language telling their troops to kill them all. In one famous example, nits make lice. The general was challenged by his own soldiers saying, this is a village. It's all kids and women here. And he said, kill them all. Nits make lice. They will grow up to be our enemy. So kill them now. That's the same language that we've been hearing from Israeli leaders. So that's the first requirement, that there be that intention. The other part of what it means to carry out genocide is carrying out at least one of five different actions to make real those goals. And those actions are killing members of the group, doesn't mean all of them, just some of them, injuring members of the group, either physically or mentally, creating conditions that make the survival of the group as a group impossible, things like destroying the entire infrastructure in Gaza so there is no way to get access to electricity, to water, to food, there's no shelter. That's what it means to say destroying the conditions of life. And then one that has only recently been included, which has to do with removing children from the group, the transfer of children. So all of these things are documented in the South African document here. One of the things that's so important about it is that it puts in the context of international law the actions that Israel is taking. It goes on to unequivocally condemn all violations of international law by all parties, and they explicitly condemn the direct targeting of Israeli civilians by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups. But it goes on to say that no armed attack on a state's territory, no matter how serious, even an attack involving atrocity crimes, can provide any possible justification for or defense to breaches of the Genocide Convention, whether as a matter of law or morality. So it's a very sophisticated understanding of what the Israeli situation was on October 7th and what they had the right to do and not do. The South African application calls for emergency action. There's going to be a hearing next week, very fast in terms of how international legal institutions usually operate, which will determine whether there can be an initial call. And we should be clear that the qualification for falling within the terms of the Genocide Convention, it's a rather low bar when it comes to the emergency part of it, because the convention doesn't only put obligations on all of the signatories and states party to the convention, meaning the countries that are bound by the treaty, and there's a lot of them. It's about 165 countries around the world have ratified the Genocide Convention, of course, including the United States, puts an obligation on all those countries to do whatever they can, not only to stop a genocide when it's occurring, but to prevent it from happening in the first place. So because the goal is prevention, the standard of proof is somewhat lower because you can say what Israel is doing has not yet reached the qualification of being genocide. And so the answer to that is maybe not in your view, but it's moving in that direction. So we have an obligation to stop it. So I'm actually quite optimistic that there will be an emergency finding that Israel is required to stop its aerial bombardment, to stop its occupation and ground invasion of Gaza, all of which are killing people in the hundreds every day, and that they have to make food and water and electricity and shelter immediately available in Gaza. All of these things can be included in an emergency decision by the court.
The United States has said it will not be affected by any determination of genocide the International Court of Justice reaches. I imagine that Israel would not either, but you think the determination of genocide would affect other countries' actions?
Absolutely. I think that, for example, many countries around the world buy both advanced military equipment and more significantly, more frequently, and a bigger part of the Israeli economy. Countries, governments around the world buy Israeli equipment for monitoring people, the kinds of things like the NSO group in what was known as the most sophisticated kind of spyware that is being sold anywhere in the world is coming from Israeli corporations. It may be that many, many countries among those 165 that are bound by the terms of the Genocide Convention will decide they're no longer going to buy that kind of surveillance gear from the Israeli companies. That will have a huge impact on the Israeli economy. So there's a lot of options for countries around the world that are concerned about their own legal obligations. Again, this comes back to what do people do in all these countries that are obligated under the convention to act? What are we going to do? When there's a finding of genocide, we have a new basis to go to the U.S. courts, for example. There's already a court case in California brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of a number of Palestinian human rights organizations and several individual Palestinians and Palestinian Americans who have filed a lawsuit already against President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken and others in federal court focused on their complicity in Israel's acts of genocide by providing weapons, providing funding, refusing to hold Israel accountable, all those things. This kind of a finding will make a court case here in the United States much more powerful because the Genocide Convention, once it was ratified by the Senate, is part of U.S. domestic law. So you cannot, in the United States, violate that convention with impunity. You can claim that the court shouldn't have found that way, but they did, or that's what we hope, and that's what they will say at that time. And that's an important tool for mobilizing in this country to force our government to stop its own complicity in these acts of genocide.
Israel has pushed the Palestinian population in Gaza to the south. Many believe Israel's aim is to force the population into Egypt or to other third countries. Could you discuss what's going on in the occupied West Bank? Do you think Israel has a similar aim in mind for the Palestinians there? Even before the war, there were calls by extremist Israelis to expel Palestinians from the West Bank. And there's been escalating settler violence since October 7th, with 9 or 10 communities in the West Bank forced to relocate because of settler violence. Do you see any?
The goals of Israel have not really changed since the founding of Israel. They have always spoken, and this is not every single Israeli, obviously, but the mainstream dialogue in the country is that Israel was a land without a people, for a people without a land after the Holocaust. Now, the people who had survived, Jews who had survived the Holocaust, clearly were at that point a people without a land. There were hundreds of thousands of people left in displaced persons camps across Europe. The United States, where most of them wanted to go, and Britain, where many of them wanted to go, were not happy about taking in Jewish refugees. There was enormous levels of anti-Semitism in the U.S. at the highest levels at that time, and in Britain, the same. You combine that with a level of anti-communism. There were claims that all these Jews were communists. There were all kinds of efforts going on in Washington and elsewhere to keep out large numbers of Jewish immigrants from coming in. The creation of Israel and the U.S. embrace of that process was partly about providing an alternative for where they could send Jewish survivors of the Holocaust who wanted to come to Brooklyn in most cases. That's where their families were. But very, very few were actually allowed to come. One of the things that the right wing in Israel, which is now not only ascendant at the popular level, but is dominant in government, has always wanted to do has been to make real the notion that Israel would control all the land with virtually none of the people, or as few of the people as possible. That began with what the Palestinians call the Nakba in 1947-48, in the creation of the State of Israel, when 750,000 Palestinians indigenous to that country, to that land, were expelled from their homes, dispossessed of their land, and became refugees. And those people and their descendants, who now number almost 5 million people around the world, paid the price for that theft of land. What we're seeing now is the last parts of it. Gaza is not part of the ideologically claimed land the way the West Bank is by the right-wing settlement movement and the ultra-Orthodox religious Zionists, the religious Zionist parties and others who want the West Bank, want all of it, and want as much as possible to get the Palestinian population out of it, concentrated in very small areas or kicked out altogether. The same is true in Gaza, except that Gaza isn't even part of that historic land of Palestine that they claim to want to return to. They just want people out of the way. This has been a long-standing goal of many of the parties that are now in the government in Israel. What we're now seeing is that kind of ethnic cleansing is taking the form of concentrating this incredibly crowded Gaza Strip, one of the most crowded strips of land on earth. Now, 2 million of those 2.3 million people in that population have almost all been forced into one-third of the territory of that overcrowded strip in the far south near the town of Rafah. Rafah, before October 7th, had a population just over about 150,000 people. It's a small town right on the Egyptian border. There's now over 1.5 million people crowding into Rafah with no shelter, with not even tents, with no water. UNICEF has now said that 1 million children, that's half the population of Gaza, are food insecure. A famine is looming in Gaza. The UN officials say that the rise of massive food insecurity, for which they have a rating system that's been around for about 40 years, that this decline in food access has been faster and more severe than any other example in the history of this food insecurity rating system. Right now, 90% of the population of Gaza are hungry. 50% of the population is starving. There is no food accessible. There's no water. There's no electricity. People are already facing severe diseases, perfectly curable diseases, waterborne diseases, because there is no clean water. So people are forced to drink salty water, dirty water. The sewage system has not been repaired. Those who are lucky enough to be in a shelter, a UN school or a mosque, for instance, are facing situations where there is one toilet for more than 500 people, most of whom are now suffering from diarrhea. So imagine the problems of lack of access to water and all that that leads to. There's disease looming. Children are, of course, the most vulnerable, along with the elders. We are looking at an absolute catastrophic humanitarian crisis that is underway and getting worse on a daily basis.
That was Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies talking about the war in Gaza and the growing risks of a wider war. Our conversation took place January 6th. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine.